She'd known about it, though. There was no surprise on her face.
"Why's that, then?"
Jamie asked in a tone of mild curiosity.
"She's not decided Denzel doesn't suit her, I hope. For I doubt he's taken to beating her."
That made Rachel laugh, briefly, but out loud, and the company relaxed a bit. "No," she said. "I believe Dottie to be pleased in her marriage. I know my brother is."
The smile lingered in her eyes, though her face grew serious as she glanced at Ian, then turned to Jamie.
"Her eldest brother has died. He was a prisoner of war, held in New Jersey. Her brother Henry received news yesterday confirming his death. But Henry cannot bear the strain of so long a journey yet, especially with the roads so dangerous, and Dottie feels she must go to her father."
Jenny gave her a sharp look, which sharpened a bit further as she turned it on Ian. "The roads being so dangerous," she repeated, with a mild tone that matched Jamie's and fooled no one.
Ian grinned at her and took a fresh chunk of bread, which he dunked in his stew.
"Then a farsh, ma'am," he said. "There's a wee band of folk again, travelling north. They're agreeable to going by New York. We'll be guy safe with them."
"What sort of folk?" Jenny asked suspiciously.
"Quakers?"
"Mohawk," he said, the grin widening. "Come out with me and Rachel after supper, ma'am. They'd be that pleased to meet you."
I could honestly say that in all the time I'd known her, I'd never before seen Jenny Murray gobsmacked. I could feel Jamie vibrating with suppressed hilarity next to me, and had to look down into my bowl for a moment to regain my own composure. Jenny was made of stern stuff, though. She took a long moment, took a longer breath, pushed Rollo's nose out of her lap, and then said calmly,
"Aye, I'd like that. Pass me the salt, Fergus, eh?"
In spite of the general amusement, I hadn't forgotten what Rachel had said about Dottie's brother Benjamin, and I felt a twist of surprisingly acute pain, as though someone had knotted a length of barbed wire round my heart.
"Do you ever make bargains with God?"
If Hal had offered such a bargain, evidently God had declined it.
"Oh, God, Hal, I'm sorry."
"I'm so sorry to hear about Dottie's brother," I said, leaning forward to talk to Rachel. "Do you know what happened?" She shook her head briefly, and the firelight, now behind her, cast shadow on her face from the curtain of dark hair.
"Henry had had a letter from their brother Adam. He'd had the news from someone on General Clinton's staff, I think he said. All it said was that whoever had written the letter wished to express their regrets as to the death of Captain Benjamin Gray, a British prisoner of war who'd been held at Middlebrook Encampment in New Jersey, and would General Clinton's office please relay this sad news to the captain's family. They'd thought it possible that he was dead, but this seems to put the matter beyond all doubt, alas."
"Middlebrook Encampment is what they call the place in the Watchong Mountains where Washington took his troops after Bound Brook,"
Fergus remarked with interest.
"But the army left there in June of last year. Why would Captain Gray be there, I wonder?" "Does an army travel with its captives?" Jamie asked, raising one shoulder in a shrug. "Save if they're taken when the army's on the move, I mean."
Fergus nodded, conceding the point, but seemed still to be pondering something. Masali stepped in before he could speak, though, gesturing at Ian with her spoon.
"Speaking of why are your friends going north?" she asked. "Hasn't anything to do with the massacre at Andrewstown, has it?"
Jenny turned toward her son, intent. A closed look came over Ian's face, though he answered calmly enough.
"It does, aye. Where did you hear that?"
Masali and Fergus shrugged in unison, making me smile involuntarily in spite of my distress over Hal's son.
"The way in which we hear most of the news we print," Fergus amplified. "A letter from someone who heard of the matter."
"And what do your friends have in mind to do about the matter?" Jenny asked.
More to the point, Jamie said, twisting to address Ian. What do you have in mind to do about it?
I was watching Rachel on the other side of the table, rather than Ian, but I saw a look too faint to be called anxiety cross her brow. Relaxing in the next instant, when Ian replied flatly,
Nothing.
Perhaps feeling this too blunt, he coughed and took a gulp of beer.
A dinner ken anyone who was there, and as I havena any intent to turn my coot and fight for the British we tie in da nigger. Nay, he finished, setting down his cup. I'll go as far as New York to see Dottie safe, and then come back to wherever Washington might be.
He smiled at Rachel, and his face, shifting abruptly from its usual appealing, half-homely expression to a startling attractiveness.
I need my scouts pay, after all. Have a wife to support.
You must come and stay with us, then, Masali said to Rachel, while Ian's gone, I mean. I hadn't time to wonder exactly where she planned to put Rachel. Masali was ingenious, and would doubtless find a place, before Rachel shook her head. She wasn't wearing a cap, but wore her straight dark hair loose on her shoulders. I could hear the whisper of it against her dress as she moved. I shall go with Ian to fetch Dottie. Rollo and I will stay in camp with my brother until Ian returns. I can be useful there. Her long fingers curled and flexed in illustration, and she smiled at me. Thee knows the joy of useful occupation, Claire, I expect. Jenny made a nondescript noise in her throat, and Masali snorted briefly, though without rancor. Indeed I do, I said, my eyes on the slice of bread I was buttering. And which would you rather find useful occupation in, Rachel? Boiling laundry? Or lancing the boils on Mr. Pinckney's arse? She laughed, and the arrival of Henri Christian, with an empty bowl in his hands, saved her replying. He set it on the table and yawned sleepily, swaying on his feet. Ah, it's late, wee man, his mother said to him, and, picking him up, cradled him in her arms. Lay your head, Avalach. Papa will take you up presently. More beer was fetched. The little girls collected the empty bowls and put them in the bucket to soak. Germaine vanished outside into the gathering dusk for the last few minutes of play with his friends. Rollo curled up to sleep by the fire, and talk became general. Jamie's hand rested warmly on my thigh, and I leaned against him, laying my head briefly on his shoulder. He looked down at me and smiled, squeezing my leg. I was looking forward to the Spartan comfort of our pallet in the loft, the cooling freedom of shift and nakedness, and the sharing of whispers in the dark. But for the moment, was more than content to be where I was. Rachel was talking across Masali to Fergus, Masali humming quietly to Henri Christian, whose round, dark head lolled on her bosom, his eyes almost closed. I looked carefully at Rachel, but it was much too soon to see any signs of pregnancy, even if... And then I stopped, startled, as my eye caught something else. I'd seen Masali through her pregnancy with Henri Christian, and I was seeing a bloom on her cheeks now that wasn't from the warmth of the room, a slight fullness of the eyelids, and a subtle softening and rounding of face and body that I might have recognized earlier had I been looking for it. Did Fergus know, I wondered, and glanced quickly at the head of the table to see him looking at Masali and Henri Christian, his dark eyes soft with love. Jamie shifted a little beside me, turning to say something to Ian on my other side. I turned too, and saw that Ian's eyes were also fixed on Masali and Henri Christian, with a look of wistfulness that smote me to the heart. I felt his longing and my own for Brianna. Roger and Jem and Mandy. Safe, I hoped, but not here. And I swallowed a lump in my throat.
You'd die for them happily,
Hal had said in the long night watch when I'd kept him breathing.
Your family. But at the same time you think, Christ, I can't die.
what might happen to them if I weren't here.
He'd given me a wry and rueful smile.
And you know bloody well that you mostly can't help them anyway. They've got to do it, or not, themselves.
That was true, but it didn't stop you caring. It was hot and close in the loft, with a comfortable lingering sense of supper crammed in under the rafters, the more argumentative pungencies of ink, paper, buckram and leather that had built up all day, and the faintly pervasive scent of mule straw underlying everything. I gasped at the impact as I stepped off the ladder and went at once to open the loading door that looked out onto the cobbled alley behind the shop. A blast of Philadelphia rushed in, fluttering the stacks of paper. Smoke from a dozen nearby chimneys, an acrid stink from the manure pile behind the livery stable down the street, and the intoxicatingly resinous scent of leaves and bark and brush and flowers that was William Penn's legacy. "Leave 1 acre of trees for every 5 acres cleared," he'd advised in his charter. And if Philadelphia had not quite met that ideal, it was still a particularly verdant city. "God bless you, William," I said, beginning to shed my outer clothes as fast as possible. The evening air might be warm and humid, but it was moving, and I couldn't wait to let it move over my skin.
"That's a kind thought, Sassenach," Jamie said, stepping off the ladder into the loft. "Why, though? Is the lad in your mind for some reason?"
"What? Oh, William," I said, realizing. I hadn't actually meant your son, but naturally... I fumbled to organize an explanation, but gave it up, seeing that he wasn't really attending. "Were you thinking of him?"
"I was, aye," he admitted, coming to help with my laces. "Being with the weans and the bairns and all so comfortable together."
His voice died away, and he drew me gently to him, bent his head to mine, and let it rest there with a sigh that stirred the hair near my face. "You wish he could be part of it," I said softly, reaching up to touch his cheek.
"Be part of the family." "If wishes were horses, then beggars would ride," he said,
and let go with a wry smile visible in the glow from the kitchen below.
"And if turnips were swords, I hae one by my side."
I laughed, but my eye went to the stack of Bibles where he was accustomed to leave his sword. His dirk was there, his pistols, shot bag, and a scatter of oddments from his sporran, but no sword. I squinted to be sure I was seeing aright, but I was.
"Us sold it," he said, matter-of-factly, seeing the direction of my glance. "It's one good thing to be said of war. You can get a good price for a decent weapon."
I wanted to protest, but didn't. He wore weapons with a lifelong ease to the point that his knives and guns seemed a part of him, and I didn't like to see him diminished by the loss of any. But without an army commission, he likely wouldn't need a sword immediately, and we did certainly need money. "You can buy another when we reach Wilmington," I said practically, returning his favour by unbuttoning his breeks. They slid off his lean hips and fell, puddling round his feet. "It would be lovely for William to know the truth about Bree and her family sometime. Will you tell him?"
"In the event that he ever comes within speaking distance of me without trying to kill me?"
One corner of his mouth curled ruefully.
"Aye, maybe. But I maybe wouldn't tell him all the truth."
"Well, perhaps not all at once, no," I agreed. A warm breeze from the window stirred his hair and the tails of his shirt. I fingered the creased linen, warm and damp from his body. "Why don't you take that off?" He looked me over carefully. I was standing now in nothing but my shift and stockings. A slow smile spread into his eyes.
"Fair's fair," he said. "Take yours off as well, then."
Claire was lovely, standing white and naked as a French statue against the deep twilight from the open window, her curly hair a storm cloud round her shoulders. Jamie wanted to stand and look at her, but he wanted a lot more to have his cock inside her. There were still voices down in the kitchen, though, and he went and pulled the ladder up.
Wouldn't do to have Jermaine or one of the girls scamper up to say good night.
There was a hoot of laughter from Ian and Fergus below, probably at sight of the ladder disappearing, and he grinned to himself, laying it aside. They had their own wives, and if they were foolish enough to sit drinking beer instead of enjoying their beds, it was none of his affair. Claire was already on their pallet when he turned from the edge of the loft, a pale shadow under the gloom of the ink casts. He eased himself in, naked, beside her, touching her curving hip. She touched his cock. "I want you," she whispered. And suddenly everything changed. It was their common magic, but magic nonetheless. The smell of onions and brine on her hands, the taste of butter and beer on her tongue, a tickle of hair on his shoulder, and a sudden rush when she ran a finger down the crack of his ass, which drew him straight up hard between her willing legs. She made a sound that made him put a hand over her mouth, and he felt her laugh, hot breath against his palm. So he took his hand away and stopped her noises with his mouth, lying full on her for a moment, not moving, trying to wait, not able to wait for the feel of her squirming under him, slick and slippery, rubbing her nipples on his, urging him. And then she quivered and made a small noise of surrender that freed him to do as he would. And he did. Jamie heaved a deep sigh of utter relaxation.
"I have been wanting to do that all day, Sassenach. Morantain canian."
Is that a bat?
It was, a flittering scrap of detached darkness ricocheting from one side of the loft to the other. I grabbed Jamie's arm with one hand and pulled a corner of the sheet over my head with the other. It wasn't that I minded bats as such. A bat whizzing to and fro 3 feet over my head in the dark, though.
"Dinna fash, Sassenach," he said, sounding amused. "It'll go out again directly."
"I'm not so sure of that," I said, slapping something ticklish on my neck. "There are probably any number of insects in here for it to hunt." Clouds of gnats and mosquitoes were inclined to roam in through the open loading window when evening fell, and it was always a Hobson's choice: keep the window closed and die of suffocation, or open it and be chivvied all night by crawling feet and the irritating snee of mosquitoes whining in our ears.
"You ought to be pleased about the bat, then,"
Jamie told me, rolling onto his side and using another bit of sheet to blot a sheen of sweat from his chest.
"How many bugs did you tell me they eat?"
"Well, lots," I said. "Don't ask me how I remember this, but according to Brianna's encyclopedia, the average little brown bat can eat up to 1,000 mosquitoes in an hour."
"Well, there you are, then," he said. "I dinna think there can be more than 200 or 300 mosquitoes in here just now. It shouldn't have taken more than a quarter of an hour to deal with those."
It was a definite point, but I wasn't quite convinced of the virtues of entertaining a resident bat. I did emerge from my makeshift shelter, though, peering upward. What if more bats come in?
"Then they'll clear the place in 5 minutes."
He sighed briefly.
"Do you want me to catch him, throw him out and close the door, Sassenach?"
"Oh," I said, envisioning Jamie pirouetting around the loft in the dark, either being bitten by a startled bat if he succeeded in catching it, or plunging over the edge of the loft in the effort to do so. "No, that's all right. Tell me what you didn't want to say earlier. That will take my mind off it." He rolled onto his back, hands clasped on his stomach.
"It's only... I've been talking with Fergus and Ian about coming with us when we leave for the ridge. Didn't I want to mention it at table, though? Ian and Fergus should talk it over with Rachel and Masali by themselves first. And I didn't want the bairns to hear. They'd go mad with excitement, and Masali would run me through the heart with a meat skewer for stirring them up just before bed."
"She might," I said, amused. "Oh, speaking of Masali, I rather think she's pregnant."
"Is she now?"
He turned his head to me, deeply interested.
"Are you sure?"
"No," I admitted. "I can't be sure without asking her nosy questions and examining her. but I think there's a good chance of it.
If so, that might affect whether they go with us, mightn't it?
The prospect of going home was suddenly real, in a way that it hadn't been even a moment before. I could almost feel the breath of the mountains on my bare skin, and goose flesh rippled fleetingly over my ribs at the thought, in spite of the heat.
Jamie said, though absently. I suppose it might. Do you think, if she is wee child, might the new one be like Henri Christian?
Probably not, I said, though professional caution made me add, I can't be positive that his type of dwarfism isn't a hereditary condition, because Fergus doesn't know anything about his family. But I think Henri Christian's is probably a mutation, something that happens just once, a sort of accident. Jamie gave a small snort.
Miracles only happen once too, Sassenach, he said. That's why all bairns are different.
I wouldn't argue with that, I said mildly. But we'll need to be travelling quite soon, won't we? Even if Massali is pregnant, she won't be more than 3 or 4 months along. A small sense of unease crept into my mind. It was early September. Snow might begin to close the mountain passes as early as October, though, if it was a warm year... How long will it take, do you think, to get back to the ridge?
Too long to make it before the snow, Sassenach, he said gently, running a hand down my back. Even if I manage the money and find a ship to take us down to North Carolina. And I'd rather do that.
You would, I blurted, astonished. You? Take a ship? I thought you'd sworn you'd never set foot on one again, unless it was the ship taking your coffin back to Scotland.
If it was only me, then I'd rather walk to North Carolina, barefoot over hot coals. But it's not. It's you and...
Me? I sat up straight, angry. What do you mean by that? Ah! I clutched my hair and dived into his lap, for the bat had zoomed within inches of my head. I actually heard its faint squeaking and the leathery flap of wings. Jamie laughed, but with a faint edge to it. As I sat up again, he ran a hand down my right side and rested 2 fingers over the fresh scar there.
I mean that, Sassenach, he said, and pressed.
Very gently, and I kept myself from flinching at the touch. But the scar was still red and tender. I'm fine, I said, as firmly as possible.
I've been shot, Sassenach, he said very dryly, more than once. I ken what it feels like. And how long it takes to get your full strength back. You nearly fell over in the street today and...
I hadn't eaten anything. I was hungry and...
I'm no taking you over land, he said,
in a tone that brooked no argument.
And it's not only you. Though it's mostly you, he added in a softer tone, smoothing the hair off my face. But there are the wee bairns as well, and now Massali, if she wee child...
It's a hard journey, lass, and dangerous for a by.
Did you not see the Duke told you the British mean to take the south now?
I said, but allowed him to pull me down next to him. Yes, he did. But I've no idea what that might actually mean in terms of where they are or what they're doing. The only battles I'd actually heard of beyond Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill are Saratoga and Yorktown. That's where it ends. Yorktown, I added.
Obviously a few things must happen in between, though.
Obviously, he said.
Aye, well, I'll buy another sword when we get to North Carolina, and have money again.
He did, in fact, have considerable assets in North Carolina. But there was no way of retrieving any of the gold hidden in the Spaniard's cave there, even if he had trusted anyone to do so. No one knew where the cave was, save him and Jimmy. And the aging whiskey, almost as valuable as the gold, if brought to the coast for sale, was in the same place.
I suppose the price of a good sword isn't quite enough for ship's passage for 9 people.
No, 11, if Ian and Rachel come too, is it?
No, he said thoughtfully. I said to Fergus that he might consider selling his press. He doesn't own the premises, Ken, but the press is his.
He made a small gesture encompassing the building around us.
There's my Bonnie in Wilmington, after all.
Your... Oh, your press.
Of course.
I hid a smile in his biceps. He invariably spoke of, well, her, with a certain possessive affection.
Come to think, I wasn't sure I'd ever heard him talk about me that way.
Aye, Fergus has his mind set that he'll go on being a printer, and I think that's wise. Germaine's not yet big enough to plough, and poor wee Henri Christian never will be.
I suppressed my speculations as to just what Germaine's reaction might be if forcibly removed from the environs of a thriving city and plunked down behind a plough. He might remember the ridge fondly, but that didn't mean he wanted to be a farmer.
What about Richard Bell?
Bell was the loyalist who had been forcibly deported from his North Carolina home and sent, penniless and friendless, to England, ending up eventually in Edinburgh, where he had found employment as a printer, and where Jamie had encountered him and made the bargain whereby Richard would bring Bonnie to North Carolina and look after her in return for his passage home.
"A dinner, Ken,"
Jamie said reflectively.
"I wrote to him to see we were coming to Wilmington and that we must make some arrangement, but I've had no reply."
This didn't necessarily mean anything. Letters frequently were lost or late. Jamie shrugged a little and shifted, stretching as he resettled himself.
"Aye, well, let that bide. We'll see when we see." "How's our wee friend?"
"Our... Oh." I looked up, scanning the low ceiling, but saw no trace of the bat. I didn't hear any whining mosquitoes either.
"Well done, bat," I said appreciatively.
Jamie laughed, low in his throat.
"Remember sitting on the stoop and watching the bats come out in the summer evenings on the ridge?"
"I do," I said softly, and turned on my side to embrace him lightly, hand on the curly hairs of his chest. "I did remember. The ridge. The cabin Jamie and Ian had built for shelter when we first came there. And the white piglet we'd bought, who had become the fearsome white sow, terror of the entire neighbourhood. Our friends, Jamie's tenants, Lizzie and the Beardsley twins." My heart squeezed at some of the memories. Malva Christie, poor doomed child. And the bugs, Jamie's trusted factor and his wife, who had proven a good deal less than trustworthy. And the big house. Our house, gone up in flames, and our life there with it.
"I'll need to build the new house first thing," he said thoughtfully.
He laid his own hand on mine and squeezed it.
"And I'll make you a new garden. You can have half the money I got for my sword to buy seeds."
Chapter 114. Belief is a wise wager. September the 10th, 1778, New York. Hal gave a mild snort.
"I don't like your going alone," he said.
"I don't like it either," John said matter-of-factly, corking his hip flask. "But the only person who could effectively go with me is you, and you can't, because of the regiment, so..."
"God, I miss Tom Bird," he said impulsively. "Your erstwhile valet."
Hal smiled, despite the worry of the situation.
"How long has it been since you've seen him? 10 years at least, surely."
"At least that."
Thought of Tom still gave him a slight pang. Tom had left his employment, with deep regret on both sides, in order to marry and had become a successful publican in Southwark, his wife having inherited a thriving public house from her father. Grey couldn't begrudge him his happiness, but he still sorely missed Bird with his sharp eyes, quick mind, and anxious care for Grey's person, as well as his clothes. He glanced down at himself. His current valet managed to keep him decent, a task that he himself admitted to be Sisyphean, but lacked both imagination and conversation.
"You should take Mark regardless," Hal said,
having evidently followed his train of thought without difficulty.
Someone's got to keep you in order.
He gave John's uniform a critical look.
I can dress myself, you know, John said mildly.
As for the uniform.
He glanced down and shrugged.
Bit of a brush-off, clean shirt, spare stockings. It's not as though I mean to be calling on General Washington. We can only hope.
Hal's lips pressed together. He'd already expressed his reservations, if anything so violently explicit could be described in such terms, regarding Gray's intent to travel as himself in uniform.
I've had quite enough of being arrested as a spy, thank you, John replied. Beyond the risk of being hanged out of hand, the American sense of hospitality. Though, come to think, I'd meant to ask, do you know Watson Smith? He used to be a captain in the 22nd, I think.
Hal frowned in concentration, but his brow cleared almost immediately.
I do, he said. A very good officer. Did well at Krefeld and Zorndorf.
He cocked his head to one side, brows raised.
Why?
He's turned his coat. He's now a colonel in the Continental Army. I was his involuntary guest for a short time. Nice fellow, Gray added fairly. Got me drunk on Applejack.
Doubtless with the intent of extracting intelligence from you.
Hal's expression made it clear that he doubted there'd been much in that line for Smith to extract.
No, Gray said thoughtfully. I don't think so. We just got drunk together. Nice fellow, he repeated. I was going to express the hope that I wouldn't meet him again. Shouldn't like to have to kill him, I mean. But I suppose it isn't beyond belief that I might run into him somewhere.
The thought gave him a small, pleasant clench low down in the belly that rather surprised him.
Anyway, he added, I'm going in uniform, even if grubby uniform. It won't necessarily keep me from arrest, imprisonment, starvation and torture, but it will save me from being hanged. Torture?
Hal gave him a look.
I had in mind waking up after the Applejack, John told him, and the singing. Have you any idea how many verses the Americans have for Yankee Doodle?
Hal grunted in response to this and took out a leather folder from which he extracted a thin sheaf of documents.
Here are your bona fides, he said, handing them over. They may help, assuming firstly that you're captured or detained rather than shot on sight. And secondly, that your captors take the time to read them.
Gray didn't trouble to reply to this, being occupied in thumbing through the documents. A copy of his warrant of commission, a note from Hal as colonel of the regiment, detaching Lieutenant Colonel John Gray temporarily from service, and desiring him to undertake the task of locating and assisting one Mrs. Benjamin Gray, née Aramanthus Cowden, widow of Captain Benjamin Gray, late of the 34th Foot, a to-whom-it-may-concern letter from Clinton, formally recognizing Gray's mission, and requesting that every courtesy and assistance be provided him in consequence thereof. Several bills of exchange drawn on Coutts Bank in New York, just in case, Hal told him.
In case of what? In case you get knocked over and relieved of your gold, half-wit.
Oh. And Benedict Arnold's note, granting the Duke of Pardlow and his brother, Lord John Gray, permission to abide temporarily in Philadelphia for the purpose of searching for the Duke's nephew.
Really? Gray said, raising his brows at this last. Under what circumstances do you think this might be helpful?
Hal shrugged and straightened his waistcoat.
The fact that you and I are known to General Arnold is worth something. The note doesn't give his opinion of us, after all.
Gray gave the note a critical eye, but in fact, Arnold had refrained from personalities and had not codified his threats regarding rails and tar and feathers.
All right.
He closed the folder and put it down, laying his hat on it to ensure against walking off without it.
That's that, then. What's for supper?
John Gray was enjoying a confused but pleasant dream involving spring rain, his dachshund Roscoe, Colonel Watson Smith, and a great deal of mud, when he gradually became aware that the raindrops on his face were real. He opened his eyes, blinking, to discover his niece, Dottie, holding his pitcher in one hand and sprinkling water from her fingertips onto his face.
"Good morning, Uncle John," she said cheerily. "Rise and shine."
The last person injudicious enough to say that to me in the morning came to a most unpleasant end, he said, struggling upright and rubbing the sleeve of his nightshirt across his face.
Really? What happened to him? Or was it a him?
She dimpled at him and set down the pitcher, wiping her wet fingers on her skirt.
What an improper question, he said, eyeing her.
Well, I am a married woman now, you know, she said, sitting down with an air of extreme self-possession. I am allowed to know that men and women occasionally share a bed, even outwith the bonds of matrimony.
Outwith? Where did you pick up that barbarous construction? Have you been speaking to Scotchmen?
Constantly, she said. But what happened to the unfortunate person who tried to roust you from your slumbers?
Oh, him.
He rubbed a hand over his head, still surprised at feeling the hair so short, though it had at least grown enough to fall over and lie somewhat flat, rather than sticking straight up like a shaving brush.
He was scalped by Red Indians.
She blinked.
Well, that will teach him, to be sure, she murmured.
Gray swung his legs out of bed and gave her a pointed look.
I don't care how married you are, Dottie. You are not allowed to help me dress. What the devil are you doing here anyway?
I'm going with you to find Ben's widow, she said. And all of a sudden, her bright facade collapsed like papier-mâché in the rain.
Tears welled up in her eyes and she clamped a hand hard over her mouth to prevent them falling.
Oh, Gray said. Oh, my dear.
And pausing only to fling on his banyan.
Even in emergency, there were limits.
He knelt beside her and gathered her into his arms.
It's all right, he said softly to her, rubbing her back. Ben may not be dead after all. We think he's not, your father and I. We certainly hope he's not, he thought, but opted for the most positive view of the situation.
You don't?
She choked, sniffed, and sat up a bit, looking up at him with drowned cornflower eyes.
Certainly not, he said firmly,
and dug in the pocket of his banyan for a handkerchief.
But why not?
She accepted the proffered linen, somewhat crumpled but not indecently so, and dabbed at her face.
How could he not be?
Gray sighed, caught between Scylla and Charybdis, as usual, when enmeshed in one of Hal's situations.
Does your father know you're here?
He asked as a delaying tactic.
No,
she said, clearing her throat and sitting up straighter.
I went to his quarters, but he was out, so I came on here to find you.
How is it that you're sure Ben's died?
Gray stood up, and tying the belt of his banyan, began looking about for his slippers. He knew that Hal hadn't yet written to Minnie about Ben. Wouldn't do so unless forced by dreadful certainty. And even if he had, there was no way in which word could have come back to Dottie so soon. And Hal would not have told his daughter the news until he was sure, no more than he would have told his wife.
Henry told me, she said.
She poured a little water onto the handkerchief and commenced repairs to her complexion.
I went to visit him and Mercy, and he just had a letter from Adam telling him... You're sure he isn't dead?
She asked anxiously, lowering the handkerchief to gaze at him.
Adam's letter said he'd heard it from someone on General Clinton's staff, telling him for sure that Ben had died at a military camp in New Jersey. Middlebrook, I think he said it was called.
No, we're not sure, he admitted, but we have reasonable grounds for doubt, and until those have been completely explored, we will proceed on the assumption that he's not. I do have to find his wife, though, he added, and child.
Dottie's eyes flew wide.
A child? Ben has a baby?
Well, the woman who claims to be his wife has a son, or so she says. And she did say that Ben is the father of her offspring.
Seeing that there was little alternative, he apprised her of the letter from Amaranthus Cowden that Hal had received in Philadelphia, and its contents.
Now, as Ben didn't happen to mention this woman to Hal, one of the duties I'm to carry out for your father is the determination as to whether she's telling the truth. And if she is, then, of course, I will bring her back with me, and the family will take care of her and the child.
What if she's not telling the truth?
Dottie's distress was rapidly being subsumed by a combination of hope and curiosity.
God knows,
Gray said frankly. Would you like to go and ask Marks to see about breakfast for us, Dottie? I may be out of bed, but I'm in no way equipped to conduct hypothetical conversations before I've had a cup of tea.
Oh, yes, of course.
She rose, though slowly, plainly still thinking about the revelations, and went toward the door, but paused on the threshold and looked back at him.
I am coming with you, she said firmly. We can talk about it on the way.
Hal walked in as the kippers and mixed grill were being laid out. He halted for a split second as he saw Dottie, but then came on, more slowly, eyeing her.
Good morning, Papa,
she said briskly, rising and coming to kiss his cheek.
Sit down and have a kipper.
He did sit down, still eyeing her, then switched his gaze to John.
I had nothing to do with it, Gray assured his brother. She arrived. How did you get here, Dottie?
On a horse, she replied patiently, taking a slice of toast.
And where is your husband? Hal asked mildly. Does he know where you are?
Denzel is where his duty takes him, she said rather tersely, with the Continental Army. Mine takes me here. And of course he knows.
And he had no objection to your travelling alone from Pennsylvania to New York over roads infested by...
I wasn't alone.
She took a delicate bite of her toast, chewed and swallowed.
Ian and some of his Mohawk friends brought me. The Mohawks were travelling to some place north of here.
Ian? Is that by chance Ian Murray? Gray asked, but then answered himself. I suppose it must be. How many Mohawks can there be named Ian? I take it that he survived his wound, then. I'm pleased to hear it. How did you come to... Dorothea, said Hal in measured tones, staring at Dottie. Why are you here?
Dottie returned his stare, her jaw visibly clenched.
Because of Ben, she said, unable to keep her voice entirely steady. Are you... Papa, are you sure he's not dead?
Hal took an audible breath and nodded.
I'm sure, he said in his best command voice. But John could see his knuckles whiten as he clutched a teaspoon and felt the knot in his own stomach tighten in response.
Dottie clearly had her own doubts, judging from her glance at her father, but she obligingly nodded. Being Dottie, of course, she didn't stop there.
How? She said. How do you know? Adam and Henry both think... the worst.
Hal's mouth opened a fraction of an inch, but nothing came out. John thought that Hal ought really to have been prepared for this, but after all, his brother had been having a difficult time. And, in all justice, it was hard to be prepared for something like Dottie.
I suppose you'd better tell her, John said. If you don't, she'll likely write to Minnie.
Hal shot him a glance full of venom, fully aware that this helpful suggestion had been made with the intent of forcing him to divulge his reasoning to Dottie. But there wasn't much of a choice, and he did so with as much grace as he could.
But this Captain Richardson hadn't done anything to Willie, Dottie said, frowning a little. I thought...
Not on this occasion, John said briefly. But given his earlier behaviour over the dismal swamp and Quebec, we're somewhat suspicious. And the man apparently has deserted,
Hal pointed out.
You don't know? He might have been killed by someone and his body concealed,
Dottie pointed out logically.
He was seen leaving the camp, John said patiently, alone. And given what we know and surmise about him, I think we have grounds to consider the possibility that he might be an American agent.
He was himself fairly well convinced of it,
viewing all his experience of Richardson now with the clarity of hindsight.
He'd been an intelligencer himself for some years, and every instinct he possessed was presently shouting, "Stinking fish," with regard to Ezekiel Richardson.
"I blame myself extremely," he said apologetically to Hal. "I should have been on to him much sooner, but I was distracted at the time."
Distracted?
Blown sideways and more than half obliterated by the news of Jamie Fraser's death.
Even the memory of it was enough to close his stomach. He put down the forkful of kipper and tasted. "All right," Dottie said slowly. Her own breakfast was congealing on her plate. So was Hal's.
"So you don't believe Ben is dead because this Richardson told you he was? And you think Richardson's a wrong'un? But that's all."
She looked intently at her father, her young chin trembling slightly, begging reassurance. Hal closed his eyes for an instant, opened them, and looked at her directly.
"Dorothea," he said softly, "I have to believe that Ben is alive. Because if he isn't, then your mother will die of heartbreak. And I will die with her."
There was a moment of long silence, during which Gray heard the passage of carts in the street, and the muffled voices of his valet and a bootblack in the corridor. Dottie made no sound at all, but he felt he could hear, too, the tears that rolled slowly down her cheeks. Chapter 115. The Raveled Sleeve of Care. September the 15th, 1778, Philadelphia. I woke abruptly in the dark, disoriented and alarmed. For a moment I had no idea where I was or what was happening, only that something was seriously wrong. I sat up, blinking furiously in an attempt to focus my eyes. Patted round in confusion, and found myself naked, legs tangled in a sheet, and wisps of straw prickling. Oh, loft. Print shop. Jamie. That was what was wrong. He lay next to me, but not still. He was on his side, turned away from me, body contorted, knees drawn up, and his arms crossed tight over his chest, head bowed. Shivering violently, though moonlight showed me the gleam of cold sweat on his shoulders, and making the terrible small whimpering noises that betokened the worst of his dreams. I knew better than to try to wake him suddenly, not in a small space with a lot of clutter and a steep drop 10 feet away. My own heart was pounding, and I knew his was. I eased myself carefully down beside him, facing his back. I needed to touch him, to bring him slowly to himself, or to enough of himself that he could recover alone. This wasn't the sort of nightmare eased by talking, or sometimes even by waking.
"God, no,"
he said in a heartbroken whisper.
"God, no."
I mustn't grab or shake him. I clenched my teeth and ran my hand lightly from the slope of his shoulder down to his elbow, and his skin shivered like a horse ridding itself of flies. That was all right then. I did it again, paused, and again. He took a deep, horrible gasp, choked with fear. But the violent shivering eased a little. "Jamie," I whispered, and with extreme caution touched his back very lightly.
If he was dreaming about Jack Randall, this might... "No!"
he exclaimed in a loud, fierce voice, and his legs straightened, every muscle in his body tight against his skin.
"Damn you to hell!"
I took a deep breath and relaxed just a bit. Anger was 1,000 times better than fear or pain. Anger would leave him as soon as he woke completely. The other things tended to linger. "Hush," I said, a little louder, but still softly.
Germaine often slept by the hearth, not wanting to share a bed with his younger siblings.
"Hush, Jamie. I'm here."
And with some trepidation, I put my arm round him, lightly, and laid my cheek against his back. His skin was hot. He smelled pungently of our lovemaking, and even more strongly of fear and rage. He stiffened, caught his breath, but I felt his awareness come back, instantly, the way it did when he woke to some alarm, ready to leap out of bed, reaching for a weapon. I tightened my hold and pressed my body against his. He didn't move, but I felt the thud of his heart beating hard and fast.
"Can you hear me?" I asked. "Are you all right?"
After a moment, he drew a deep breath and let it out in a long, quivering sigh.
"Aye," he whispered, and his hand reached back to grasp my thigh, so tightly that I jerked but managed not to squeal.
We rested quietly together for a time, until I felt his heart begin to slow and his skin cool, and then I kissed his back and traced the scars that would never fade from his body, over and over with gentle fingers, until they faded from his mind, and he slept in my arms. The pigeons on the roof of the boarding house made a purling noise, like the sea coming in on a pebbled shore, rolling tiny rounded rocks in the surf. Rachel was making a similar noise, snoring very faintly. Ian found it charming and could have lain watching her and listening to her all night, save that she was lying on his left arm, which had gone numb, and he needed urgently to piss. As gently as possible, he edged out from under her soft weight, but she was a light sleeper and woke at once, yawning and stretching like a young catamount in the candlelight. She was naked, arms and face the colour of just toasted bread, her body white, and her privates, under their dark brown bush, a wonderful dusky colour that wasn't either rose or violet or brown, but reminded him of orchids in the forests of Jamaica. She stretched her arms above her head, and the movement lifted her startlingly white round breasts and made her nipples slowly rise. He began to slowly rise, too, and hastily turned away before it became impossible to do what he'd meant to.
"Go back to sleep, lass," he said. "I just,
He gestured toward the chamber pot under the bed. She made a pleasant sleepy noise and rolled onto her side, watching him.
"Does thee mind my looking at thee?" she asked in a soft voice, husked by sleep and earlier muffled shrieks.
He glanced at her in astonishment.
"Why would you want to?"
The notion seemed mildly perverse, but in a distinctly arousing fashion.
He wanted to turn his back so he could piss, but if she wanted to watch him...
"It seems an intimacy of the body," she said, looking at him through half-closed eyes. "A trusting, perhaps, that thee consider thy body to be mine, as I consider mine to be thine."
"Do you?"
That idea surprised him, but he didn't object. At all.
"Thee has seen the most hidden parts of me," she pointed out, and spreading her legs, drew her fingers delicately between them in illustration. "And tasted them as well. What did it taste like?" she added curiously.
"Fresh-caught trout," he replied, smiling at her. "Rachel, if you want to watch me piss, you can. But you canna do it if you talk to me like that while I'm trying, aye?"
"Oh." She made a small snort of amusement and rolled over, turning her back and her very round bottom to him.
"Go ahead, then."
He sighed, examining his prospects.
"It will take a minute, aye?"
Before she could think of anything else outrageous to say to him, he went on, in hopes of distracting her.
"Uncle Jamie and Auntie Claire think of leaving Philadelphia soon. To go back to North Carolina, Ken. What would you think of going with them?"
"What?"
He heard the rustle of the corn husk mattress as she turned over quickly.
"Where is thee thinking of going that thee would not take me with thee?"
Oh, I didn't mean that, lass, he assured her with a quick glance over his shoulder.
She was propped on her elbows, looking at him accusingly.
I meant we'd both go to Fraser's Ridge, Uncle Jamie's settlement.
Oh.
That surprised her into silence. He could hear her thinking about it and smiled to himself.
He does not feel an obligation to the Continental Army? She asked after a moment, cautiously. To the cause of freedom?
I dinna think those are necessarily the same thing, lass, he said, and closed his eyes in relief as everything relaxed at last.
He shook himself and put away the pot, giving himself time to form a coherent sentence.
The Duke of Padlow told Auntie Claire that after Saratoga, the British made a new plan. They mean to try to separate the southern colonies from the northern ones, blockade the south, and try to starve the north into submission.
Oh.
She moved to give him room to lie down beside her, then snuggled into him, her free hand cupping his balls.
Then he means there will not be fighting in the north, so thee will not be needed as a scout here. But thee might, in the south?
Aye, or I might find another use for myself.
Outside the army, thee means?
She was trying hard to keep hopefulness out of her voice. He could tell from the very sincere way she looked up at him. And he smiled at her, putting his own hand over hers. He was much in favour of bodily intimacy, but would rather not be squeezed like an orange, should Rachel be overcome by enthusiasm.
Perhaps, he said, I own some land, Ken, on the ridge. Uncle Jamie gave it to me some years back. 'Twould be hard work, mind, clearing fields and planting and ploughing. But farming is mostly peaceful. Bar things like bears and wild pigs and fire and hailstorms, I mean.
Oh, Ian.
Her face had gone soft, and so had her hand, now resting peacefully in his.
I should love to farm with thee.
You'd missed your brother, he reminded her, and Doughty. Maybe Fergus and Marsali and the Waynes, too. I dinna think they'd come settle on the ridge, though Uncle Jamie thinks they'd maybe travel south with us, but settle near the coast. Fergus would need a decent-sized city if he's to make much living as a printer.
A shadow crossed her face at that, but she shook her head.
I will miss Denzel and Doughty, but I should in any case, for they will go where the army goes. But I will be very happy if thee does not, she added softly, and lifted her face to kiss him.
Rachel woke instantly. She hadn't been soundly asleep, her body still a hum from lovemaking, and still so attuned to Ian's that when he'd gasped and stiffened beside her, she sprang at once into awareness and had her hands on his shoulders, meaning to shake him gently out of his dream. The next moment she was on the floor in a tangle of bedding, her husband on top of her, and his very large hands vised round her throat. She flopped and wriggled and pushed at him in futile panic, and then, as her breath vanished and brilliant red stars flashed up in the darkness of her vision, she got hold of herself and brought her knee up as hard as she could. It was a lucky blow, though it missed its mark. She hit Ian hard in the thigh, and he woke with a start and let go. She struggled out from under him, gasping and wheezing, and crawled as fast as she could to the corner, where she sat quivering with her arms wrapped round her knees, chest heaving, and her heart thumping in her ears. Ian was breathing heavily through his nose, pausing every so often to grunt or to say something brief, and probably very expressive, if she'd had the wit to understand it, in either Gaelic or Mohawk. After a few minutes, though, he got slowly into a sitting position and leaned back against the bedstead. Rachel, he said warily, after a moment's silence. He sounded rational, and her tight-clasped arms loosened a little.
Here, she said, tentative. Is thee all right, Ian?
Oh, aye, he said mildly. Who taught ye to do that to a man?
Denny,
she said, beginning to breathe easier.
He said that discouraging a man from committing the sin of rape wasn't violence.
There was a moment of silence from the vicinity of the bed.
Oh, said Ian. I might have a wee chat with Denny one of these days.
A philosophical discussion on the meaning of words, like.
I'm sure he would enjoy it, Rachel said.
She was still unnerved by what had happened, but crawled over and sat beside Ian on the floor. The sheet was lying in a pale puddle nearby, and she shook it out and draped it over her nakedness. She offered half of it to Ian, but he shook his head and leaned back a little, groaning as he stretched out his leg.
Would he like me to rub it? She asked tentatively.
He made a small huffing noise that she interpreted as amusement.
Not just now, I...
They sat together, shoulders barely touching for a bit. Her mouth was dry, and it took some time to work up enough spit to speak.
I thought he was going to kill me, she said,
trying hard to keep her voice from quivering.
I thought I was too, Ian said quietly.
He groped for her hand in the dark and held it hard.
Sorry, lass.
Thee was dreaming, she ventured. Does he want to tell me about it?
God, no,
he said, and sighed. He let go her hand and bent his head, folding his arms atop his knees. She kept quiet, not knowing what to say, and prayed.
That was the Abenaki, he said eventually,
his voice muffled.
The one I killed.
In the British camp. The words were simple and bald and struck her in the pit of the stomach. She knew, he told her when he came back wounded. But to hear it again, here, in the dark, with her back scraped from the floor and her throat bruised from his hands. She felt as though the deed itself had just happened in front of her, the reverberation of it shocking as a scream in her ear. She swallowed, and turning to him, put a hand on his shoulder lightly, feeling with her thumb for the fresh, ragged scar where Denzel had cut to remove the arrow.
"The strangled the man?" she asked very quietly.
"No."
He breathed deep and sat up slowly.
"I choked him, and I cut his throat just a wee bit. And then I bashed his head in with a tomahawk."
He turned to her then and passed a hand lightly over her hair, smoothing it.
"I didn't have to," he said. "Not right that moment, I mean. He didn't attack me, though he tried to kill me before."
"Oh," she said, and tried to swallow, but her mouth had dried afresh. He sighed and bent so that his forehead rested on hers. She felt the warmth of his nearness, the warmth of his breath, smelling of beer and the juniper berries he chewed to clean his teeth. His eyes were open, but so shadowed that she couldn't see into them.
"Is thee afraid of me, Rachel?" he whispered.
"I am," she whispered back,
and closed her hand on his wounded shoulder, lightly, but hard enough for him to feel the hurt of it.
"And I am afraid for thee as well. But there are things I fear much more than death. And to be without thee is what I fear most."
Rachel remade the bed by candlelight and left the candle burning for a bit, saying that she wanted to read to settle her mind. Ian had nodded, kissed her, and curled up like a dog beside her. The bedstead was